So this morning, I'm going to talk about money. I've talked about a lot of things here, but I've never talked about money before, and I thought, why not? Everybody thinks about money all the time. money issues are endemic in our society, so why not talk about money? So Buddhist thought, Buddhist values, Buddhist teaching is what? Is that everything has infinite worth. Everything has infinite worth. A grain of sand and the beach both have infinite worth. The little hovel that someone lives in and the Taj Mahal both have infinite worth. That's a Buddhist truism, right? Whatever it is, just because it is, it's infinitely worthy. It's worth gazillions because it is, and because it's part of an interdependent, interchangeable network of life. Because it's a manifestation of that. Just in that tiny grain of sand, all life is manifested. So that's the Buddhist, sort of the central Buddhist teaching about worth, about value. And what's money all about? It's about worth. It's about value, isn't it? So how do we deal with this money thing then? How do we deal with it? I'm going to pause for a minute. Let these women get settled. So, historically, we had in our world non-money economies, and those non-money economies, some of them were meant to reflect this core value, whether they were Buddhist or not. This core value that I'm talking about. One example would be the Lakota, but there are many, many different examples of tribal communities where. The emphasis is on the infinite worth of everything, and the emphasis is on, in Lakota Metakiasin, all my relatives, the grain of sand, the Taj Mahal, the rich person, the poor person, the statesman, all my relatives. And so the ethos in these non-money economies, in these tribal societies, is to give. And the norm is to give, because since everything's infinitely worthy, you just want to give to it. But here we are in a money economy, big time money economy, in the 21st century, in which our economy has become kind of the world economy. Our attitudes and the way we deal with money has manifesting itself all over the world. So there are not too many tribal societies left. They're doing things in this tribal manner. And for the last 100 years, the two predominant economies have been Marxist and capitalist. And capitalist seems to have won out, right? Most people think capitalist has won out. A little Marxism here and there. And yet, when you look at some of the core teachings of Karl Marx, they sound a little bit more Buddhist than the capitalist teachings do. From each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. That sounds kind of Buddhist, doesn't it? That kind of sounds like the Bodhisattva who's there to help people out according to his or her ability. And it used to be okay to talk about Marxism, but now it's not even okay to talk about it in many circles, right? Because it so clearly didn't work as it was put into practice. So, but Marxism has some fundamental differences from Buddhist thought about this. Fundamental differences. One is it's a materialistic worldview. It's based on things are separate. Things are discrete, and we need to divide up those things equally, because there's no sense of interdependence. There's no sense of interconnection. And the have-nots need to get as much as the haves have, so that there's equality. And however they get that, violently or non-violently, it doesn't matter. So that's not Buddhist. That's not Buddhist. And also, it ends up pitting one group against another, which is hardly interdependence, is hardly undividedness from all of life. And we've had so many experiments in our culture and in European culture trying to live communally, trying to live either in a state form or individual form or small collective forms. And they've all petered out. They've all petered out. Now, people could say that possibly Scandinavia is doing something closest, but for the most part, they've petered out. And we had experiments in Buddhism. We had Chinese monasticism, in which the Chinese monasteries treated everyone within the monastery of equal worth, and everything was shared. Of course, there were still the guys who were enforcing it all. But the idea was that it was all interdependent within that monastery. But those fizzled out too. And then we had all our nice 60s experiments, right? Those of you who are old like me probably did a 60s experiment. My 60s experiment lasted for, 3 years of my life. 3 years of my life that I lived communally. But it was just two families lived communally. And then it fizzled out. As they did, as they all have, haven't they? Interesting. So why haven't these worked? Why haven't these worked? And what should? How can we work in an interdependence in a money economy? Well, I think they haven't worked primarily because, number one, they've been based generally on a single idea. An idea of share the wealth, an idea of everybody being equal, an idea of even everything being the Buddha nature. And as long as you try to force an idea on people, you're not really living in reality, right? T.S. Eliot said, between the idea and the reality lies the shadow. The shadow. So we know this. We know how many great ideas we have, and how in Zen practice we're trying to not be obsessed by any of these ideas, even the beautiful ones. We're trying to let go of them and just come back to this and use them, but also see their limitations. But I think because of fixation on an idea, an ideal, we've seen these communities just one after another sort of not make it. And the interesting thing to me is that Zen Buddhism now is in a small way flourishing. Where? In the United States. Not in Japan, not in China, but in a capitalist, democratic state. That's where it's flourishing. I mean, just look at this town. There are four different Zen centers. They're small, but they're all flourishing. There are several Tibetan centers. They're small, but they're flourishing. So that's an interesting and some people would say ironic. And I think that's because a couple of things. Because our culture, with its democratic roots and its capitalism too, we value the individual. We value individual effort. And Zen is all about your individual effort to still your mind, to return to your original interdependence by studying, by processing, by integrating what you've learned and then what you've let go of in your sitting practice. The individual focus, I think, works in our culture because our culture has that as a core value. And then also, our culture, in contrast to, quote, Buddhist cultures or Christian cultures, quote, we aren't fixated on an idea about how people should live. We were founded by a bunch of people who came together with lots of different ideas how to live. And they said, well, we're going to have to just let go of these fixations and live together. So we have those underpinnings. And I think those underpinnings are helping people develop meditation practices here in this country and manifest them. So in 1970, people didn't know if Buddhism was really going to catch on here. But now it's been, 45 years since I started. No, I don't know. Yeah, 44 years. 44 years since I started practicing. And it's here now. It's here. And it's rooting, taking root. Trungpa Rinpoche said once, the Tibetan teacher, that the reason he thought the Chinese were able to take over into Tibet was that each of the Tibetan lineages, the Kagyu lineage, the other lineages, were focused on their idea, on their ideal of what Buddhist practice was, and their lineage. And they had reached the point where they were warring with each other. They were fighting with each other over their lineage. And he said that made it easy for the Chinese to come in. So Americans' core values of openness to lots of different ideas maybe means that we have a chance really to root this practice in our culture. I think so. And the second reason I think that this equal sharing hasn't worked so well is that our idealism overlooks the importance of paying attention to ego. I mean, I talk a lot about ego being fiction, but on the other side, ego is not fiction. Yes, ego is fiction, but ego is also not fiction. We're all hardwired, and whether it's culturally or genetically, everybody's debating that, we're hardwired to take care of ourselves. We're hardwired to take care of the people whom we think are in our family, whether it's just me, or it's me and Ben, or it's me and the three of us, or it's me and all of you. We're hardwired to do that. And so spiritual practices that don't acknowledge that hardwiring, that don't try to work with that hardwiring, are doomed to sort of become hypocritical, doomed to lose their life. So we have to, I think, pay attention to that stuff. And interestingly enough, in Lakota culture, which I talked about at the beginning, there's this idea of giving, giving, giving. It's wonderful. Yeah, that's a norm, giving, giving, giving. But there's also a very specific mindset that the Lakotas are the people, and then there's everyone else who are not the people. And if you look at all tribal societies, you'll see that. We're the people, and we give, give, give to the people, and then there's everything else. Even though we say everything is interdependent and it's all of infinite worth, we do that. So Lakotas do that. And I'm not putting down the Lakotas. Wonderful culture. So I've told a story, but I haven't told it in several years, about being with my teacher, Elmer, when I was doing Lakota spirituality when I was younger. And Elmer told the story about Elmer didn't drink. He stopped drinking. And he was really a great medicine man, although he said he wasn't a medicine man. All the good medicine men were dead. You know. But, you know, he was just one of these guys who was really humble, right? And I was talking with him one day, and I smelled alcohol in his house, and I knew he didn't drink. And I said, boy, I smell alcohol. Somebody been drinking. You letting your kids come home and drink? Well, Elmer, he said, no. He said, what happened is this. He said, earlier today, I was at my friend's house. And we were hanging out, my friends and a few of us. And all of a sudden, there was a big explosion in the house. And we got beer all over us. There was beer all over me. And I came home and washed, but I couldn't get the smell. And I said, oh, what happened, Elmer? And Elmer said, oh, well, my friend had a case of beer, and he knew that we were all coming over. He would have to give us all the beer. So he put the beer, these people live in very small houses without cupboards, but they had an oven. And he put the beer in the oven. Knowing that his friends were coming over, he would have to give it all to him. He wouldn't have any beer. He'd just been given this gift of beer. So he put it in the oven. He knew his wife was out, but his wife came home unexpectedly and lit the oven, turned it on, and it all exploded. So this is an example kind of how we have these ideals. And they're fine to have these ideals. But we've got to pay attention to reality. We've got to pay attention to ego needs. And the more idealistic we are, the more lacking in compassion we are for just our own ego needs and other people's ego needs. And so idealism is fine, but T.S. Eliot was really right. Really right. The more idealistically we are, and the more we abstract that idealism from just this, the more there's a shadow in our lives. Research has been done on couples. This is research that you can read about in any magazine, on couples' relationships, in enduring relationships. In enduring relationships between couples and relationships that don't endure between couples, money is one of the two major issues in the relationship. The other being what? Sex. This is the research, right? Sex and money. Those are the two main issues. And a lot of it has to do with, it all has to do with ego and feeling empowered, feeling counted, feeling valued. So if one person has control of all the money, the other person feels not empowered, not of worth, left out. And so relationships that survive, that relationships that thrive, have to deal with this money issue. Because money is all around us, and have to think not only about the interdependence, but about my relationship with you, and whether we can reach some equanimity, resolution which is not based on fixed idea, but based on openness, based on multiplicity of different ways of doing things. And this goes on. Gone forever in relationship, because everything is changing. There's nothing set, so of course it goes on forever. And often, again, I saw some research just a couple of weeks ago when it talked about in dyads. Usually, there's one member of the dyad who is more conservative, who doesn't either want to give as much money or spend as much money. And then there's one person who's more liberal and thinks the other person is out to lunch. And usually that's a pattern that continues. It doesn't reverse itself too often. It just continues. There's the stingy one and there's the generous one. Or there's the person who's a spendthrift and the person who's prudent, depending on what point of view you take, right? So any spirituality which doesn't take this stuff into consideration isn't going to work. It's just not going to work. So now I want to talk a little bit about a few things Suzuki Roshi said about money. And I actually don't remember him saying anything about money, but I happened to look the other day at a copy of a newsletter from San Francisco in which he talked for a few minutes about money. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. So what he's in a talk he gave on money in 1970, because I read the date when I saw the newsletter, he said, labor is important, not accumulation of wealth. Labor is important, not accumulation of wealth. And here he says, labor makes sense when you work on things with respect. That should be the true nature of labor. But to only count the labor without having a deep respect for the thing which you are given is a big mistake. So when we work on a thing with respect, that is our human life in its truest sense. And that's very much the Zen attitude. Years ago, I remember being here on a Friday night with Katagiri Roshi, the head teacher here at the time. And we were going to have a meeting. And a couple of the people were late to the meeting. And I remember saying to Katagiri Roshi, oh, they're late because I know they were going to a TGIF party. And he said, well, what's that? So I said, well, it's thank God it's Friday. And he didn't get it. I tried to explain the whole thing to him. I went over and over, three or four times. His English, he really had good receptive language skills, but he didn't get it. He completely didn't get it because it's so foreign to Zen. The labor itself that we do, whatever labor we do, gives us life and gives life to to others. And there's intrinsic respect if we just do it, if we just give ourselves to it. So the fact that these people were going to a TGIF party, he just never understood. He never understood. So Suzuki Roshi also says, behind money is respect for the material things which are given us from Buddha. So there is respect for the labor, for the effort someone has made. And I think that's a wonderful value. And in our society, we have three different ways primarily in which we labor, which are called the first rail, the second rail, and the third rail. How many of you know this or are familiar with these? The first rail, the second rail, and the third rail? No? None of you? Oh. Okay. Well, the first rail is the for-profit sector. That's the first rail. The second rail is the public sector. And the third rail is the non-profit sector. So in this country, the third rail, the non-profit sector, this is the non-profit sector right here, Zen Center. The Greek Orthodox Church next door, it may not look like the non-profit sector, but it's the non-profit sector. In this country, the non-profit sector is flourishing like in no other country in the world. If you look at all the European countries put together, they have less going in the non-profit sector than we do. And the non-profit sector, it's not so hard for us to manifest what Zen and Buddhism is talking about. Because in the non-profit sector, we have a mission. A non-profit has a mission. And the mission always involves, or usually involves, reaching out to people, helping people in some way. Now, you may not agree with the way it's done, but they are driven not by dollars, but by mission. And so you can work for a nonprofit. You can give to a non. You have to give to a nonprofit, or a nonprofit doesn't make it. So that's why Buddhist reciprocity really works in a nonprofit, because only by giving do you receive. So we have the nonprofit sector, food co-ops, many other different types of nonprofit sectors, where it's most simple to manifest this. This Zen way of being, in respectful, open, generous way. Then we have the public sector. Public sector too is based on that, but based on the idea of providing a service, an important service, whether it be education or some other service. But because of bureaucracy, and because people often feel like they're tamped down by the unwieldiness of the bureaucracy, it's a little bit harder. And some people would say that in the for-profit sector, it's almost impossible to manifest this Buddhist way of life. But I don't think that's the case. People have said that because why? Because the for-profit sector is not driven primarily by respect for labor, by a sense of interdependence, by a sense of interconnectedness. It's driven by New York Stock Exchange, or if not the New York Stock Exchange, some smaller version thereof. So what about the for-profit sector? Most people have to work in the for-profit sector, and we're in the for-profit sector. Well, my premise this morning, and you may not agree with me, and I don't know how much I agree with myself, you know. My premise this morning is that in the for-profit sector, you can find this very same focus on a mission where money is secondary. Now, you don't always find that. You have to be careful, but you can and may find that. Some of you may have read a book that came out about 12 years ago called From Good to Great. I don't know if any of you read that book, From Good to Great. Any of you read that book? No? Oh, you read it. Okay. So From Good to Great talked about the difference between the good companies in this country and the great companies, the excellent companies. And one of the examples of the great company was Hewlett-Packard. And raise your hand if you know anything about Hewlett-Packard. I've heard that name before. Well, most of you have. Okay. Well, I just wasn't sure, that's all. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Hewlett-Packard now. And you go back and read Good to Great if you want. So the town I grew up in California, was a town where the Hewlett family lived. And I was on the cross country running team with Bill Hewlett Jr. And his dad had this deal in their garage. And his deal was that he had graduated from college. He was an engineer who was just fascinated in the possibilities that through engineering we could create technology that would help people communicate more efficiently, more congruently, more respectfully. And so what he did is he hired a bunch of people to work in his garage whom he thought had similar vision to him, and he paid them really well, although he had no money. I mean, really. And he said, I don't know exactly what we're going to do, but I think we have a chance of really, really helping people. And he treated them really, really well. Really, really well. And that was the beginning of Hewlett-Packard. That was the beginning of Silicon Valley, actually. There was no Silicon Valley where I was a kid. I rode my bike all around in the, you know, where it's now Silicon Valley, and there are a few roads, little roads, yeah. So that was the beginning. And if you know about his life or read about his life, you know that he always respected the labor and the people who were performing it. And he was always excited about the vision of, through their engineering, what they were going to create. But he never knew what it was going to be. He always collaborated. So that they always, he always had his team and they worked together. And then, of course, after he died, Hewlett-Packard had a huge controversy and, from my point of view, lost its primary mission-driven status. Maybe it's changed since. And the amendment to that story is that when I went back to California to... my dad was not doing well at all. We had someone in taking care of my dad who would come every day, taking care. And my dad was really cantankerous. He wasn't cantankerous when he was young, but I think the pain as he got older made him more and more crabby. And so he did not treat this woman well at all. He did, and it really hurt me to see how well he treated her. And once. After he had been treating her really badly, I went in and was just consoling her, and she said to me, "I wish Bill Hewlett hadn't died." I said, "Oh, Bill Hewlett?" She said, "Yes, before I worked for your dad, I worked for him." She said, "He was so wonderful." He said, "Even though he couldn't walk, he only cared about me when I walked in the room. He only cared about whether I'd had my lunch. And here, he couldn't get up to fix me lunch. He still would have ideas about how I could get lunch." And she said, "Geez, here I'm stuck with your dad." Yep. Yep. Not the only person. So, within all three rails, we have the opportunity to discover this. We have to discover this possibility, to really value. But it's not that easy. It's not that easy. That's why we're focused in Buddhism not primarily on outer wealth, but primarily on cultivating inner wealth. Inner wealth. Historical Buddha in the Nikayas even uses the term inner wealth. And he says seven things. You know, these are always numbers, right? Do you know why they're always numbers? Because it's not a written culture, it's an oral culture, and the way they remember it is by enumerating it. So I doubt if he said seven things, but anyway, seven things. Seven things through Zen practice, will be developed. And those will yield inner wealth. Conviction, virtue, a sense of conscience, scrupulousness, breadth of learning, generosity, and discernment. Oh boy. These are the inequalities that we build through our meditation practice and our reflection. And then outer wealth, today it may be ours, tomorrow it may not be ours. The next day it may be ours. It becomes less important. It no longer drives our lives. We're no longer obsessed by it. We still, I think, need to have a prudent attitude toward it, but we're not driven by it. And studies have shown a zero correlation between money and happiness. Do you know about those studies? A zero correlation between money and happiness. And instead, they've shown the highest correlation, I said in my last talk, between what and happiness? Relationships and happiness. Really high correlation. Not the number of relationships, but the quality, the respect, the interchange, the love. So supposedly a historical Buddha also was asked about by a lay person about all of his land. A lay person owned all of his land. And Buddha didn't say give it away. He said don't let your property sit idle. Plant crops on your land. So this would be the idea of making use of our material possessions to bring life. to bring life, to make things alive. Share so that we ultimately feel generous and feel that we're quite wealthy through that generosity. So now I want to close with a couple of quotes by Suzuki Roshi. He says, money is important. It expresses the value of things which change. And he says, life is always about exchange. So money is a perfectly good form of exchange. It's a symbolic form of exchange. And then he says, a genuine exchange is a purification in which the person who gives doesn't feel that he doesn't owe anything anymore. And I should say, as an adjunct to that, the person who receives doesn't feel like he doesn't deserve anything anymore. So it's an open set. It's not fixed. Not fixed. And if we focus on just engaging in it, it doesn't need to become fixed. Just being part of it. Especially if there's a feeling of mutual respect. And if we look at Bill Hewlett's example, he didn't know where he was going. He just did this over and over again, and he really got back. But then he established the Bill and Hewlett Flora, the Bill and Flora Hewlett Foundation, which have done wonders to help. NPR gets more money, or historically has gotten more money from the Bill and Hewlett Flora Foundation than all the other Bill and Flora Hewlett Foundation than all the other foundations put together. Suzuki Roshi says, money is not yours, it belongs to society. And then he says, a lot of people say money is dirty, but money is not dirty. It's our attitude toward money that's dirty. If our attitude is pure and we think of it as this simple exchange and we do our labor with respect, then our life works. And then he ends this talk that he gave in 1970. And he gave this, I'm saying he gave this in 1970 because in 1970 in San Francisco, which is where I'm from, there was still a group of people who came to Zen Center every day and never gave a dime. A really large group of people, because we were in the counterculture and we were money was not relevant to us or something. I don't know. I don't exactly remember. And so he was, even in 1970, he was still, he'd been here for a few years, he was still getting half of his support from the Japanese. The Japanese were not too happy about this. And so he was saying, so he closed his lecture by saying, and if you're going to study with me, you need to give. You need to give money. And that's the end. Was the end of his talk. And since then, the nonprofit sector has grown in this country, and all of the Zen centers, all the Buddhist centers around the country, have that nonprofit ethos, that ethos of people give and people get to support the mission, of interdependence, the mission of mutual respect, which takes labor, but labor is not a dirty word. It's just giving yourself to whatever you're doing. That's all. So I think that's what I want to say for this morning. I'll be glad to entertain questions or comments. Yeah?
I'm unclear as to the shadow comment.
Pardon?
I'm unclear as to the shadow comment.
Oh.
T.S. Eliot.
Oh. Oh, she's unclear about what T.S. Eliot meant. Well, I can say what I mean, but I can't say what he meant by when he said between the idea and reality lies the shadow. What I meant is that we get so fixated on our ideals about how this Zen center should be, for instance. How this Zen center should really be different. People should be da-da-da-da-da or da-da-da-da-da, and they're only da-da-da-da-dying or da-da-da-da-dying, right? And the more we're fixated on that idea of what it should be like, the harder it is for us to just to be here, just to accept what is, just to have a feeling of respect for each other as we are with all of our warts. And so there's a shadow, a huge shadow. The more we cling to the ideal, the more the shadow makes us think, God, do I even want to be here? Maybe I'll go over there to the Greek Orthodox Church, you know. And then after we've been at the Greek Orthodox Church for a few years and the teaching of Jesus, are they really doing? Boy, look at how money, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The shadow. And through the self-emptying process of Zazen, we can, to a degree, let go of that and see that that idea is fine, that ideal is fine, but it's not something that we should marry ourselves to. If we do, we're going to become pretty rigid and pretty uncompassionate to ourselves and others. Does that make sense?
Yes, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When it comes to the totality of the message, I very much was in agreement with it. There was one point.
Okay.
At one point you said, you know, in a relationship there's usually a stingy and a generous part.
Yeah.
And you equated the stingy party with the conservative and the generous.
Oh, yeah, well, forget that.
Well, I just want to say I'm very conservative in that regard.
Yeah.
And I'm also, on a personal level, I'm very generous when it comes to people in need and whatnot.
Yeah.
I just happen to be of the opinion that charity should come from the private individual rather than the public sector.
Oh, sure.
And I mean, a lot of people think I'm heartless because I oppose public charitable forms, but. You know, on a private level, you know, things like the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
Whatnot. So, I mean, I just...
Well, I completely agree with you. Those words were just... Yes, I completely agree with you. You know, in my relationship with my wife, I'm the skinflint.
Oh. Okay.
That's her turn, not my turn. I'm the skinflint.
I mean, one time I was pretty much the sole employee of this given company.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty much the sole guy with conservative convictions. Mm-hmm. And when the blood drive came, I was also the only person to donate.
Uh-huh.
So, conservative...
So I don't mean this... I wasn't using that word politically.
Okay.
I didn't mean it with a political connotation.
I'm not telling...
Not politically.
Other than that, everything was very...
All right, okay.
Sorry, it's the first time.
Yeah.
Your comments today are most timely. I read two of the articles I read yesterday. One was talking about the concern that the best and brightest from our top colleges are gravitating to the financial marketplace where they're making unconscionable sums of money and not producing anything of real value versus what A. Bill Hewitt did in dedicating that millions to creating something.
Yeah.
Another was on Bhutan where they measure a deeply Buddhist culture where they measure production on gross national happiness, not gross national profit.
Ah, very good. Could you guys hear him? Not too well. Well, he was contrasting two types of people, type of people who are gravitating to Wall Street types of careers just to make money, and another type of people who are focused on measuring gross national happiness, and those would be the Bhutanese. That's one of their core values. Did I leave something out?
No, that's it.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah. We had a comment about, if I remember correctly, in the nonprofit sector, you know, the mission is first and money comes after that. And you're hoping that we can apply that into the personal or public sector.
Yep.
I think that goes right along with, I don't know, I watched a little bit of a fair amount of Susie Orbit. She's got her message has a lot of heart and spirit to it, and it is about you have to do what follow your bliss or follow the path, and the money will follow.
And the money doesn't always follow. It doesn't always follow. I mean, you know. So I watch her too, but. But even if the money doesn't follow, if you give, you get back. And you don't realize it, you get it back. Katagiri Roshi here for years, he was just here every day. He just here. He was only interested in doing Zen practice. I thought it was a little extreme. We always used to want to get him to go on vacation. He didn't even know what vacation was. He was always here, and he really was just trying to give his dharma from his heart. And by the end of his life, my friend visited him in the hospital, and he said, "Well, Hojo-san," that was what we called him, "thinks that he has not been successful. And he doesn't know if the Dharma is going to continue. He didn't feel like he'd gotten back, in a way. And I won't talk about what the Zen Center was like then, or what the different Zen Centers were like, but that's how he felt. Well, since his death, we have I would say 8 or 10 different thriving different Zen Centers around the United States who are people who are his devoted students. And we have another dozen or two Buddhist centers around the country which were deeply influenced by him. And when I go to places to teach, they say, "Oh, you hung out with Katagiri? Like, wow." So we don't always get it back, but we do get it back. It's always coming back. Anything else? Thank you.